energy and how we get it affects everyone. Someone loads coal in a chute in a Western North Carolina power plant, and someone else turns on a light in the Triangle. But how will we get that energy in 10 or 20 years?
What can it be by 2050? I mean, I would like to see us move to 70 to 75% nuclear by then.
We're still going to burn a lot of coal at the plants where we've invested.
We have a very persuasive and convincing argument for why coal is the dirtiest energy source.
It's the problem with all of energy. Every single source, no matter what it is, has its warts. There's a problem with all of them, even solar.
I'm Eric Hodge with a special from WUNC News, North Carolina Voices, Tomorrow's Energy. Over the next hour, WUNC reporters travel the state and talk to those who are charting the future of the production, distribution, and consumption of energy in North Carolina. Our program begins with reporter Dave DeWitt exploring two questions that are central to the issue of energy. How much will we need, and how will it be produced?
Like most people in my generation, I learned everything I need to know from Schoolhouse Rock. How a bill becomes a law, conjunctions, even electricity.
Electricity, electricity. Burning fuel and using steam, they generate. Electricity, electricity.
When that song and video first aired in the 1970s, electricity seemed just that simple. You burned coal to make steam, steam powered a turbine, and it made electricity that powered the 8-track player in your shag-carpeted den. But now, making electricity is much more complicated, and the effects are more dangerous, especially here in North Carolina.
The Southeast is the most energy-inefficient region in the United States, and the Southeast emits more greenhouse gases per person than any other region in the United States.
Ivan Erlob is the executive director of the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association. He says North Carolina is both high growth and high carbon, and the state is years behind in addressing the challenges that creates.
For a long time, coal was cheap, and we didn't know, we didn't fully understand the negative costs of using so much coal. Now we do.
Two utility companies serve the majority of the state, Duke and Progress Energy. Both are highly regulated for-profit companies. At the center of their business is the challenge of figuring out how much power will be needed in the future and how much it will cost to meet that need. Almost every facet of society is considered. Will population growth continue? Will tobacco farms become server farms? And will we keep our houses at 73 degrees in the summer or 75? Lloyd Yates is the CEO of Progress Energy Carolinas. He says consumer behavior is especially hard to pin down. He points out that household appliances are 20 to 30% more efficient than ever, but the average customer is using 60% more energy than he did 30 years ago.
So why is that? Well, that's a lifestyle issue. Well, if you think about over the last 25 or 30 years, our customers have moved to larger homes. Those homes are now primarily air-conditioned space. They have iPods, computers, cell phones, flat-screen televisions, microwaves, washers and dryers, and on and on and on. So we have to think about those things because they drive behavior.
Everything Progress and Duke officials think they know about how much electricity we will need in 10 or 20 years goes into an annual report called the Integrated Resource Plan, or IRP. Then mid-level managers gather in the basement of a nondescript state government building in Raleigh every March to address the state's Utilities Commission.
PUC's resource plan includes a forecast of annual summer and winter seasonal peak loads.
Attorneys from environmental and consumer groups cross-examine the utility companies on what they see as an over-reliance on coal and an unwillingness to invest enough in renewable energy sources like biomass, solar, and wind. Ivan Erlob says the problem is how the state regulates the utility companies.
Right now, our utilities can minimize their financial risk, maximize profit, and make the most expedient decisions by relying heavily on nuclear and then coal. In the other states, the regulatory environments do not encourage that. They encourage something different.
Erlob points to California and Colorado, where more emphasis is placed on efficiency and renewable energy. It's just one example of the diversity of opinion around energy issues, and many often seem counter to what you might think. Duke's CEO, Jim Rogers, has stated publicly his support for government regulation of greenhouse gases. At the same time, his company is building a massive coal plant at Cliffside in Rutherford County. And some environmentalists embrace nuclear because it doesn't produce carbon. Something they all agree on is that we are fast approaching a crossroads, a point of no return when energy decisions will have long-lasting health and economic consequences. Lloyd Yates of Progress Energy.
This next 5 years, 5-10 years, will be a significant turning point for this industry. I think it is a significant, I'll call it an inflection point, of whether or not renewables become a significant contributor to the energy portfolio in the U.S.
They may argue over every detail, but ironically, all sides, utility companies, environmentalists, regulators, consumers, eventually want the same thing, cheap electricity provided in a safe manner. But they have very different ideas on how to get there. Dave DeWitt, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
New businesses to help save the planet are popping up every day. As a result, your ability to do environmental good may be closer to your fingertips than you think. Already, there are pockets of households and businesses in North Carolina that are able to control their heaters and air conditioners online or from their smartphones. They're living on a smart grid that's becoming smarter and smarter every day. Next up, reporter Leonita Inge has the story of one smart grid pilot project in Fayetteville.
James and Cynthia Wilson live in a 6,000-square-foot, two-story brick home in Fayetteville, surrounded by sky-high pine trees. There's a swimming pool in the backyard. And there are solar panels on the roof, one of many signs the Wilsons are leaning towards a more environmentally friendly, energy-efficient lifestyle.
And this is the device that transmits the signal. So this is the radio control, if you will, so you have access to the computer.
James Wilson has handled all the new smart grid technology in the home since joining the Fayetteville pilot project organized by the city's Public Works Commission. He looks at how they're using electricity and programs things like when the hot water heater comes on and when the air conditioner kicks in. Cynthia Wilson has some say, though.
Take the input from one person, and another person has to be responsible for keying it in.
It's kind of like you see sign on thermostats and do not adjust. So he's the one that does the adjustments, unless I say, turn it back on.
Inside the Wilson home, they have a new thermostat. Temperature adjustments can be manipulated online, even turned off when no one is at home. In this video, the fictitious Clark family also lives in a two-story home and is enjoying their new technology, developed by Raleigh-based Concert.
Hello, I'm Mr. Clark, and I'm really excited that my power company has installed the free automated energy management system in my home. Let's take a quick look at what they did.
Concert partnered with the Fayetteville Public Works Commission, IBM, and Verizon Wireless to get the pilot program going. The program includes James and Cynthia Wilson and about 100 other households and small businesses. Oh, and the Clarks.
They installed a wireless communication device next to my electric meter. Here, they installed a device that will measure the amount of electricity used by my HVAC unit and one for my water heater. Now, all those appliances are controlled and managed by an automatic system for me.
Concert says regardless of the future mix of energy resources, there must be an intelligent and efficient power grid, a smart grid that provides financial incentives for all players. That includes the customer and the power provider. Jack Roberts is CEO of Concert. He says the pilot project in Fayetteville shows customers saved an average of 16% on their energy bills between September 2009 and January of this year.
Well, it turns out that consumers like the knowledge and control. They like saving money. They like to believe that they're part of the greenness, that they're conserving.
But they also want smart meters to be secure. Robert says it's a serious issue, not because someone could hack the system to tamper with your electric usage, but because they could go upstream into the electric grid.
We have encryption at the IBM level. We have encryption at the Verizon level. We use a private network so that we're using IP addresses, Internet Protocol addresses, which are not available to the general public. We use multiple firewalls. We've given this more than a little thought.
Concert is also working with NC State on its BIC Freedom Project. That stands for Future Electric Energy Delivery and Management. The National Science Foundation recently awarded the project $18.5 million. Experts say smart grid technology like this has endless possibilities, including opening the door for virtual peak power plants, creating an alternative to the more costly construction of physical power plants. But will your everyday North Carolinian jump on board in a state that is not ranked particularly high in energy efficiency? Larry Klubine has.
I remember when we were talking about this pilot program, and I was like, sign me up, because anything to save money. That was my primary.
What about the environmental factor?
Oh, I'd love to.
The energy factor.
Love to help the environment. But, you know, I'm about my wallet first.
Klubine has lived and worked in Fayetteville for nearly 30 years. He's part of the Concert pilot project and says he hopes it will continue. The Smart Grid pilot project in Fayetteville is wrapping up. The Public Works Commission is conducting its own survey and is expected to decide soon if it will continue the project or not. In the meantime, Concert says it will have secured 10 pilot projects across the country by the end of the year. Leonita Inge, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
This is North Carolina Voices, Tomorrow's Energy, a special broadcast from WUNC News. I'm Eric Hodge. Every time you hit the light switch, half the power you use is supplied by coal. It's one of the cheapest and most dependable fuels we have. It's also the dirtiest. As regulators crack down on carbon and other emissions, some say we should stop using coal altogether. Others aren't sure that's a realistic goal. Laura Leslie reports.
The Cape Fear plant in Moncure sounds like a power plant. You can hear the hum of the turbines as you drive onto the grounds, but it doesn't look much like you might expect. It's a beautiful old red brick building with soaring ceilings. Progress Energy spokesman Mike Hughes says it was one of the first coal-fired utility plants in North Carolina.
This was a plant that was built in 1923, so it's been providing service for almost 90 years to CP&L and Progress Energy customers.
Inside the door sits one of the plant's original generators, a 1923 General Electric. It still works. Standing next to it is shift supervisor Gordon Parker. He takes us through the pulverizers, where the coal is ground into dust, and past the compressors that blow the dust into the furnaces. Parker was born and raised in Moncure, and this is the only place he's ever worked. You can tell he's proud of it.
But this is the very top of the boiler. That's your steam drum, and then you got all your components. You got miles and miles and miles of tubes.
The plant's power output comes from two 1950s turbines up on the seventh floor. That's where the hum comes from. Up here, it's so intense it makes the steel floor vibrate under your feet. To Parker, it's music, but not for much longer. Progress will shut it down by 2017. Spokesman Mike Hughes says it would have cost hundreds of millions of dollars to retrofit the plant with scrubbers required by the state's Clean Smokestacks Act of 2002.
That was one of the central questions, is how much money do you spend, do you invest in a power plant of that vintage? So it's a very real economical decision, and the economics made a lot of sense for the decision that we made. It was a very difficult decision, but the right one.
Gazing out at the coal pile behind the plant, Parker is the first to admit his plant isn't as efficient or as clean as newer facilities. He understands why it's being mothballed, but it still hurts to think about it.
Yeah, it does. That's from my life. You know, I've got 29 years invested down here, and just my family. I mean, just my family away from home. You know, all the guys down here, all the people.
Cape Fear is one of four coal-fired plants Progress is closing down. They're all either intermittent or peaking plants, the ones that come online when demand rises and stop when it drops. Spokesman Mike Hughes says they're being replaced by two new plants that burn natural gas. That should reduce Progress's coal use from 13 million tons a year to around 10 million.
We're still going to burn a lot of coal at the plants where we've invested billions of dollars in retrofit technologies for these criteria pollutants, et cetera. But in the areas where we had the older, less efficient coal-fired power plants, it makes much more sense for us economically to build new gas fueled generation.
Natural gas is about 50% cleaner than coal, but it's never been the fuel of choice for North Carolina utilities, partly because we don't have much of a pipeline system, but more so because of its price volatility. For example, after Katrina, the cost of gas tripled. Hughes says new discoveries of deposits in the northern Appalachians and new ways of extracting them should help keep prices stable and low for a while.
Which economically puts gas in the money, if you will, and makes it a more viable means of producing electricity than some of our older, less efficient coal-fired power plants.
But Hughes says natural gas won't work as a long-term solution. While it's cleaner than coal, it's still a fossil fuel. He says some in Congress are calling for carbon reductions of as much as 80% by 2050. If that happens, even natural gas won't make the cut. The only viable fuel that would is nuclear. To be viable for utilities, a fuel source has to be two things, dependable and cheap. That's why we get so much of our power from coal. Steve Calland is director of the Solar Center at NC State. He says, as a country, we've gone to great lengths to make electricity cheap and available. As an economic policy, it's been a huge success. It's helped put us at the top of the global economy.
And that's what the electric utility industry is all about and has historically been all about, is low cost and reliable. And that's been their mandate, and they've done it very, very well. You know, the issue is that in the rush to get to low cost and reliable, there are other factors that are, you know, part and parcel of using coal-fired electricity that haven't been, you know, accounted for in the process.
For example, Callan says, take transportation. One reason coal is cheap is that we have a cheap way to move it, our federally built rail system.
The coal industry and the electric utility industry, as it grew up, you know, they kind of grew up hand in hand, and the railroad industry was kind of the third partner. Basically, in this country, if you didn't have railroads that were sited in such a way that they could move coal back and forth cheaply around this country, the cost of coal-fired power would be, you know, tremendous, and we'd be, you know, looking at other options for our energy today.
Callan says coal's environmental and health costs are even more important. It's been blamed for a long list of problems, from climate change to lung disease and environmental toxins. He says regulations help to expose those costs by turning them into dollars and cents. Every scrubber and filter utilities have to buy to comply with those laws is paid for by consumers. As coal gets pricier, other fuels get more competitive. Callan thinks renewables will win out at some point, but not yet.
It's the problem with all of energy. Every single source, no matter what it is, has its warts. There's a problem with all of them, even solar. And most of the solar issues deal with the relative cost and the issues of intermittency. You know, you have to build a lot of solar to make up for a coal-fired power plant, a whole lot of solar. And even then, you've got to have storage to go with it, or you've got problems, you know, for example, at night.
For now, Calland expects to see more nuclear power. He doesn't think we really know the long-term cost of dealing with nuclear waste, but he says there's a growing consensus it may be the best choice until renewables become viable on a large scale. Cleaner coal technology is another option. He says the world's two biggest economies, the U.S. and China, both have enormous supplies of coal.
If no other options pan out, you know, we're going to use them because nobody's going to turn off their television or their refrigerator or their kegerator or whatever it might be, just because somewhere down the road the Outer Banks might wash away. Unfortunately, people just don't think that way.
Progress Energy isn't planning any more coal-fired plants. Duke, however, is just about to open one. Its controversial new unit at Cliffside is scheduled to go online in 2012. Spokesman Andy Thompson says coal will continue to play an important role in Duke's fuel mix.
We have, you know, invested, you know, billions of dollars in emission control equipment on our large baseload units, which has significantly cleaned up the emissions from those plants, so that we can continue to rely on that fuel source and that very efficient generation for years to come.
Duke CEO Jim Rogers has said Cliffside will be his company's last new coal plant in North Carolina. Like Progress, Duke is switching off some older coal plants and replacing them with natural gas. And both companies are planning to add nuclear units, too. Duke in South Carolina and Progress in both Florida and North Carolina. Laura Leslie, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
Energy companies are predicting that the need for power will grow in North Carolina in the coming years. With climate legislation likely, they're turning back to an energy source that has been put on the back burner for several decades. Nuclear. In February, President Obama announced $8 billion in loan guarantees for a Georgia utility company hoping to build new nuclear reactors. Progress Energy and Duke Energy both have plans to also build new nuclear plants to serve customers in North Carolina. Reporter Dave DeWitt has the story of how nuclear may play into the state's future.
Jim Warren has been waging war against the nuclear power industry for about two decades from a small White House on a busy street in West Durham.
It's not a level playing field. It would be different if they were Goliath and our side was David, and Goliath plays fair or fights fair.
Warren is the executive director of the North Carolina Waste Awareness and Reduction Network, a watchdog group that has fought bitter battles against the utility companies for years. And he's won some. N.C. Warren was able to halt Progress Energy's practice of putting spent nuclear fuel rods on rail cars and moving them to the Sharon Harris nuclear plant near Raleigh. But that victory, like the country's apprehension with nuclear power, is beginning to seem like a long time ago.
To create more of these clean energy jobs, we need more production, more efficiency, more incentives. And that means building a new generation of safe, clean nuclear power plants in this country.
President Obama made this pronouncement on the most public stage possible, his State of the Union address. And the applause came from both sides of the aisle, a rare show of unity during hyper-partisan times. He likes nuclear for the same reason many environmentalists now do. It produces no carbon. Even James Hansen, the godfather of climate change and perhaps the most influential environmental scientist in the world, likes nuclear. He spoke about it when he visited UNC Chapel Hill earlier this year.
If you look at the damage that has been done to humans and the environments by nuclear power and compare that to what has been done by coal, you're talking several orders of magnitude. The safest large industry in the United States has been nuclear power.
New nuclear plants are in the works for both of the major utilities that serve North Carolina. Duke Energy wants to build a reactor in South Carolina. Progress wants to build two additional reactors at Sharon Harris. To get that done, it will take billions of dollars in federal loan guarantees, a decade or so of regulatory activities, and strong public support. And building that public support means TV commercials.
Progress Energy is ready. We're meeting your energy needs with money-saving efficiency programs, alternative energy, and advanced carbon-free nuclear.
As the narrator describes carbon-free nuclear, we see a father and son fishing in a boat on Harris Lake, while in the background is the iconic cooling tower of the Sharon Harris nuclear plant, wide on the bottom, thin in the middle, and wide again at the top. That tower is the first thing you see when you pull up to the well-fortified security gate outside Sharon Harris.
All right, pulling up to this security gate. It's around the corner. Wow, there's the cooling tower. It's a lot bigger than I thought it would be.
This is as far as I can take recording equipment, so here's what happens on a tour of a nuclear power plant. First, wear cotton. Wool and polyester retain too much radon and set off the radiation sensors. The only protection you'll need is a hard hat and a pair of safety glasses. Security is tight. In addition to several checkpoints, every once in a while a guard with an automatic rifle pops up from around a corner. The control room is surprisingly low-tech. Your average sports bar has more pizzazz. No flat screens here, just rotary dials, analog gauges, and five very attentive, no-funny-business nuclear supervisors. They don't allow reporters inside the core, which is okay with me, but I can stand on the edge of a repository of spent fuel rods. The uranium rods sit 25 feet beneath the boron-infused water. When the lights are off, they emit a blue glow. Behind us is the reactor, inside 4.5 feet of cement and rebar and another 5/8 of an inch of steel. And although it's not enriched enough to make a bomb, the uranium inside is equivalent in amount to 1,000 times the nuclear material that was dropped on Hiroshima. That heat makes steam that turns turbines that send electricity to nearby Cary, Raleigh, and beyond. Back outside, the tour guide points out where the new reactors might be built, just north of the current one. Lloyd Yates, the CEO of Progress Energy Carolinas, says that while a final decision hasn't yet been made about building new reactors, the company has to keep its options open.
I don't expect us to really be making a decision to build a nuclear in North Carolina or in the Carolinas before 2012.
But Yates also says he hopes nuclear can be the fuel to replace outdated and dirty coal. Currently, Progress produces 50% of its electricity by burning coal and about 47% from its nuclear plants.
What can it be by 2050? I mean, I would like to see us move to 70 to 75% nuclear by then. I think there's some significant hurdles between now and then to get there, but I'd like to see us there by then.
Those hurdles include cost. Projections are that two new nuclear reactors at Sharon-Harris would cost around $9.3 billion. Progress Energy's current market capitalization is a little more than $11 billion. To get those reactors built will take years of wrangling over regulations and financing and scores of public hearings. Jim Warren will likely attend every one. But even his position on new nuclear has evolved. He's still concerned about security and waste, but he thinks climate change is at a tipping point. So he's leaving the door open for nuclear just a little.
It helps to feel confident that we have the facts and that we have a solid argument, and then we're pushing to have society debate, and we're eager. We're dying to have these issues out on the table, and we're willing to be wrong if we are wrong.
Warren was swayed by James Hansen's support of so-called fourth-generation nuclear power. It would take those spent fuel rods currently resting at the bottom of the Sharon-Harris pool and reuse them to generate electricity, thus reducing waste. That, and a justified fear of climate change, are just a couple of the reasons many believe that increasing nuclear power generation is a good idea, and why decision-makers are closer to making a multi-billion dollar bet on it. Dave DeWitt, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
This is North Carolina Voices, Tomorrow's Energy, a special from WUNC News. You can hear the entire series, interviews about energy from the state of things, and find more about this state's consumption and production of electricity online at WUNC.org. This series was made possible in part by grants from the Burt's Bees Greater Good Foundation, from Progress Energy, and from the contributions of WUNC listeners. I'm Eric Hodge. This is North Carolina Voices, Tomorrow's Energy, a special from WUNC News. I'm Eric Hodge. Most energy consumers know what they pay for electricity, but very few of us know why we pay what we do. Who decides what a kilowatt should cost, and how does energy policy change that? In this segment of our special North Carolina Voices, Tomorrow's Energy, Laura Leslie reports on the complex process of pricing power.
James Dixon is on his way home from work. He just walked out of a convenience store in downtown Raleigh, where he paid his electric bill. Like most of us, Dixon has no idea why the bill is what it is or who decides that. He just knows he has to pay it, and he thinks it's too high.
It just goes up and goes up and goes up to the point where you just figure you have to pay it. You can't keep up with what they're charging and why they're charging it. You just get charged.
There aren't many of us who could do without electricity, but we don't have a say in who supplies it or what we pay for it. It's a monopoly, and that's why it's regulated by the State Utilities Commission. That's a 7-member panel that makes sure all public utilities provide reliable service in the most efficient and least costly way. When a power company wants to raise its prices, it has to get approval from the commission. That's called a rate case.
The rate case is the big deal.
Joanne Sanford was chairwoman of the Utilities Commission for 10 years before stepping down in 2007. She says a rate case is essentially a giant audit, and it takes months.
It's a judicial proceeding, and so there are discovery requests and answers and accountants and engineers and economists. Tons of people pore over company records. I mean, it's like fire ants.
The chief fire ant is James McLawhorn. He directs the electric division of the public staff. That's the independent state agency that represents consumers in rate cases, kind of like a DA in court. The public staff's job is to figure out whether the power company really needs more money, so they check to see if it's wasting money somewhere else.
During the course of that investigation, we'll be looking at the information that they are required to file, and we will be asking additional information. Every aspect of their operations is fair game.
When the audit's over, the public staff makes recommendations. The final decision is up to the commission. Utilities can file rate cases whenever they want, but facing that kind of scrutiny, they don't file very many. So what is the base rate? That's the price you pay per kilowatt hour. Most North Carolina utilities charge around a dime. That's one of the best deals in the country. Out of every dollar, about 30 to 40 cents goes to pay for the fuel to make the power. 40 to 50 cents pays for the company's operations, building, running, and maintaining the grid. Around 6 cents goes toward company debts. Around 12 cents is profit. That might sound like a pretty good return for investors, but there's a good reason for it. Building power plants is a very expensive undertaking. For example, Duke's new unit at Cliffside will cost $1.8 billion. Nuclear plants are even pricier. Again, James McLawhorn.
They are growing companies. They do need to acquire large amounts of capital, a portion of which is from the equity markets, and they need to be able to attract that.
State law guarantees power companies a, quote, reasonable return. It's up to the Utilities Commission to decide what that number might be. Former chairwoman Joanne Sanford says it's more of an art than a science.
Lots of economists stay very, very busy trying to both support and oppose views of what is a reasonable cost of capital. It is it's a hotly contested figure. It's a very important figure, and it consumes a lot of time during this rate case process. Big decision.
Sanford says that issue is likely to get even hotter in the near future as North Carolina addresses its need for more power. Apart from Cliffside, our last baseload plant was built in the 1980s. Some plants are aging out. In the meantime, our population has mushroomed, and we also use more energy now than we used to. Our appliances might be greener, but we have more of them, a lot more. Sanford says efficiency and conservation can help curb demand, but they can't offset all of it.
We're going to need more basic power supply, and that's going to cost money. And who knows how much money that's going to cost, because they're expensive, they're hard to site, expensive to build, capital costs are big. And it is a thing that must be done, I believe, for us to meet our energy needs going forward.
Whether to build new plants and what type of plants is also up to the Utilities Commission. Power companies propose new plants, and then the public staff reviews them and makes recommendations. But the criteria they use is dollars and cents. Remember, their mandate is least cost. Some environmentalists say the process doesn't account for all the costs of energy, like mercury levels in fish or health problems caused by pollution. Sanford says the formula does include the cost of complying with state and federal laws, but she says the commission's job is to implement policy, not to make it. That's up to the legislature,
where Guilford Democrat Pricey Harrison says greener policy isn't always popular.
I have to say, whenever I talk to a group, I say that there's no legislation will pass at the legislature that the utilities aren't in agreement with. And that's been my experience since I've been here. They're great people. I love working with them. But it's pretty amazing.
Harrison was an environmental advocate before she was elected to the House in 2004. Every session, she files a slew of energy bills, increasing regulation, limiting pollution, promoting efficiency. Most of them never see the light of day. She says that's because industry lobbyists tell lawmakers they'll cost too much.
There's a combination of being incredibly effective at their job, and I'm afraid there's the whole campaign contribution piece to it, too. So that's problem with a lot of the issues at the legislature, not just energy related.
The energy industry is a big donor, especially in the Senate. According to followthemoney.org, it handed out more than $800,000 in North Carolina's last election cycle. While that's not exactly chump change, it's not the biggest contributor either. The industry ranked ninth in 2008, far behind lawyers, realtors, and bankers. The thing is, energy affects all those groups, from the heaviest hitters on down, and pretty much no one wants to pay more for power. Laura Leslie, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
Universities like UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, and NC State are among the largest electricity users in the state. Some produce their own power, some buy their electricity from utility companies, and all have student bodies that are vocal in their anxiety over global warming. Dave DeWitt looks at how campuses are transforming to meet their future energy challenges.
Stuart Boss doesn't look like an activist. He's 18 but looks younger. He's wearing a green Masters golf tournament pullover and khakis, and his short hair looks like it may have a little product in it.
Maybe that kind of also speaks to like how big of an issue this is, that we're not a bunch of crazy environmental nuts like hugging trees or laying down on the train tracks trying to stop the train coming in. We have a very persuasive and convincing argument for why coal is the dirtiest energy source that we could possibly be using and why we need to get off of it as soon as possible.
Boss is speaking in the shadow of the old well. Down the road about a half mile away, boilers burn coal 24 hours a day at UNC's cogeneration power plant. Boss and other environmentalists admit it's a state-of-the-art plant, and it's also very efficient. It provides about one quarter of the electricity the campus uses, as well as steam for heating, cooling, and instrument sterilization. But it still burns coal, as do hundreds of university-based power or steam plants across the country. About 600 university presidents have signed something called the President's Climate Commitment and are developing plans to achieve climate neutrality. 18 university leaders in North Carolina have signed it. UNC is on that list. Chancellor Holden Thorpe says that a university that leads in research also has to lead on its own campus.
People expect us, in the way we conduct ourselves, to lead society in terms of what the practices that are coming later are going to be more broadly.
Thorpe has formed an energy task force to come up with a plan to reduce UNC's coal consumption by 25% by 2025 and be completely carbon neutral by 2050. But getting to those long-term goals is complicated and expensive. UNC's hands are tied by limited funding and state regulations that force it to buy the cheapest available fuel. Right now, that's coal. UNC is trying to predict what that fuel will be in the future and make its facilities ready when it becomes available. But other campuses have a different strategy.
This is the main boiler floor. We have 15 in total, 10 Mura boilers on this level, 5 up on the new mezzanine.
Russell Thompson is clearly proud of this facility. He's the director of utilities and engineering at Duke University, and this is Duke's renovated East Campus steam plant. Here, 15 brand new natural gas burning steam boilers are humming away, sending steam to campus to heat buildings and to sterilize instruments at Duke Hospital. Last year, Duke spent $15 million to completely renovate the vacant plant. When it went online in January, it immediately cut Duke's campus-wide carbon emissions by 9% and its coal use by 70%.
From an efficiency standpoint, it's about as good as you can get.
But this plant only produces steam for heat and other uses. Another one on West Campus is 3 times larger and still burns mostly coal. Duke University buys all of its electricity from Duke Energy. And until the utility company moves away from coal to a non-carbon fuel, the university's commitment to becoming carbon-free is in someone else's hands.
I mean, we are one of the top 10 customers, and so, I mean, I think we have the ability to talk to them at the fairly high levels throughout their company. From what, you know, we're being told from Duke Energy, we think they're on the right path, and it's just going to take time.
Meanwhile, students on campuses across the country continue to put the pressure on, and not just because of the future of a healthy planet. For them, it's also for something more along the lines of what you'd expect from young people who regularly paint their faces blue.
Duke should not be beating us on this. You know, they're beating us out on the basketball court, but more importantly, they're beating us in the race to get off of coal.
It's still too early to determine who will win the carbon-free race between longtime rivals Duke and Carolina. The final score won't be known until current students like Stuart Boss hit retirement age. Dave DeWitt, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
North Carolina has topped many lists in the past few years. It's one of the fastest-growing states and ranks high for its business climate. But in energy efficiency, North Carolina is waiting somewhere in the middle of the pack nationwide. Energy experts predict the down economy and heightened concerns about climate change may also help change minds, steering utilities, state government, and residents to action. Leonita Inge has the story of how communities are working towards energy efficiency.
In many ways, North Carolinians are just like everybody else.
Hey, how can you sing like that, dude?
Remember when I swallowed that little computer?
Oh, yeah.
This idea of a value-added tax or a national sales tax, not a good idea.
We've got lots of stuff. Multiple televisions, computers, electronic games, cell phones, and electric chargers to keep them going. But that's the little stuff. Air conditioners are a must in the summer, and heat is mandatory in the winter. If you mix in our low electricity rates and our traditionally lax conservation ethic, our energy consumption could swell by double digits in the next 20 years. Eitan Gummerman of Duke University is co-lead researcher for the new report, Energy Efficiency in the South.
The South has been portrayed in some circles as being behind. There's been reports out saying, you know, the southern states rank behind other states when it comes to how well they're doing on energy efficiency. And that's one way of looking at it. I see it as an opportunity.
Work by Gummerman and researchers from Georgia Tech shows North Carolina's use of residential energy as a percentage of its overall energy consumption exceeds that of the nation and the rest of the South.
Well, energy efficiency isn't just about beating yourself up because there's something that you do that's somewhat wasteful. I mean, I think, and we've talked about the low-hanging fruit aspect of energy efficiency, there are some things that are going to be easier to do than others.
Gummerman says if North Carolina really wants to cut back and become more efficient, all roads lead to the home. Melvin and Claudette Whitley live on Harvard Street in East Durham. Their brick home sits on a hill with a good view of the rec center across the street. Their home was built in 1956. They've lived there since the early 1990s.
So do you consider your home energy efficient?
No, not really.
Whitley goes on to tell me about leaks around the windows, the old thermostat inside the house, and ventilation problems that she says lets heat escape in the winter and air conditioning escape in the summer. Whitley points to the black plastic that covers one of the crawl space openings.
We just had that put there because the vents were open and all the air was coming in during the winter, and we couldn't heat. It was hard to heat the living room. We could heat the back of the house, but we couldn't heat the front. So we had one of our friends came and put that up there. But in the summertime, that's going to have to come out because you're going to have to ventilate the crawl space during the summer. Otherwise, you're going to get problems.
But recently, the Whitleys found out their neighborhood is one of six communities chosen for Durham's Neighborhood Energy Retrofit Program.
I love my neighborhood. I like where I am. And to find out that we were selected to participate, that was exciting.
The first phase of the Neighborhood Energy Retrofit Program will seal leaks, insulate attics, and install programmable thermostats in nearly 350 homes. Homeowners selected for the program will have to pay $200, but they'll get up to $2,000 worth of work. The retrofit program could not be done without federal stimulus dollars from the Department of Energy. Durham is using almost $1 million for the retrofit project. Tobin Freed is the sustainability manager for Durham City and County. She was hired to implement Durham's greenhouse gas emissions reduction plan, the first plan of its type in the state.
We've made a lot of progress, but we still have a long way to go. Unfortunately, our emissions are still increasing. It's kind of one of those things where it takes a while to get the ship that's going down the shipping lane to turn around and change course. It takes a bit of time and effort.
Freed says her office is trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 50% across city and county government and in the schools. Employees have even been handed compact fluorescent light bulbs. And the goal is to help reduce community energy use by 30%, all by the year 2030. Eitan Gummerman of Duke University says it can be done.
You know, across the board, energy efficiency needs to be attacked from many different ways. You know, local government, state, federal.
And big utilities, too. This week, Progress Energy is scheduled to launch its appliance recycling program. Customers can get a cool $50 for recycling their less efficient refrigerator or freezer. And the state's annual Energy Star Appliance Replacement and Rebate Program is this weekend. These could be the incentives people need during a time when the economy continues to struggle. Leonita Inge, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
Over the last 3 years, North Carolina has seen exponential growth in the use of solar power, from a few panels on homeowners' roofs to heat hot water to large installations that produce energy and send it right back into the grid. Small business owners working in the industry believe what they're doing is good for the state and for the environment. But right now, their prospects are limited. Jessica Jones reports.
Person County is home to one of the largest installations of solar panels in the entire state. Located just off Highway 15501, the installation is hard to miss. It's made up of 3,400 huge solar panels that face the sun.
Come inside the gate here.
Richard Hartgrader is the CEO of Carolina Solar Energy, which installed the panels last year.
Yeah, we have to have a gate and a fence around it because it's this high voltage electricity. And also, there's a lot of value here in the solar panels. We don't want anybody walking away with them.
Harkrader's company built this project in only 10 weeks last fall after 2 years of planning. Although he started this company a few years ago, Harkrader has worked on renewable energy projects for decades. For 20 years, he and his wife had a well-known construction company that built solar homes.
My interest was in both clean energy, lowering carbon, and dealing with the tremendous problem we have with climate change. I have two daughters, and my big emphasis is leaving them and my grandchildren a world that isn't compromised by what we're doing now.
That's why Harkrader works building solar installations these days. This one generates enough electricity to power about 100 homes per year. The power generated here is sold to Progress Energy and goes right back into the grid. In recent years, it has become much more affordable to install solar panels like this. Still, Harkrader says this is one of only a handful of installations in the state.
We're not generating 24/7, but we are generating very valuable peak electricity. So I think we should be building as much as we can, and that's not the case right now.
It is strange that in a Sunbelt state like this one, there aren't more solar installations. North Carolina gets less than 2% of its energy from renewable sources. Meanwhile, states like California and Colorado are using much more locally produced solar energy. Ivan Erlaub is with the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association, a nonprofit group that works to increase the public's understanding of renewable energy sources. Erlaub says many people don't understand how solar energy works, but that's not the main problem.
I don't think that people's lack of understanding of solar and wind is a barrier to its use as much as our policy and regulation at the state level and how our electric utilities perceive the usefulness of wind and solar. That seems to be the greatest barrier to really scaling up its use.
Here in North Carolina, the state's Utility Commission determines how much developers get paid per hour for the electricity they generate. Sustainable energy advocates say it's too low. And utilities get to determine exactly how much electricity they buy from individual developers like Richard Hartgrader and therefore control the market. Utilities like Progress Energy say they would like to use more solar energy, but that can't happen overnight. Mike Hughes is a spokesman for Progress.
By definition, it has to be an incremental change unless and until the regulatory framework changes. And there's not much momentum for the regulatory framework to change that dramatically, that quickly, because people value 24/7 electricity reliability.
Many utility companies are wary of expanding their use of solar energy simply because it can't be produced when the sun goes down. But renewable energy advocates say reliability isn't the problem many utilities would like consumers to believe. Right now, this state uses such a tiny amount of solar energy that it gets used up almost as soon as it's made. Other countries that do rely on larger amounts of solar energy simply turn to other energy sources when it's dark. A few months ago, a representative of Progress Energy reportedly told middle schoolers in a presentation in Chapel Hill that solar wasn't sustainable enough to use on a large scale. But children of state policymakers and local entrepreneurs were in that class, including the son of Marcus Wilhelm.
He just came home and he said, "Daddy, if you had been in school today, you would have been very, very angry."
Wilhelm started a company last year called Solar Tech South. It sells solar panels to everyone from developers to individual homeowners. Wilhelm also belongs to the state's Energy Policy Council, a diverse group of people who advise the governor on policy matters. He regularly sits at the same table with members of the Utility Commission, Progress Energy, and Duke Energy.
I believe the only way we as an industry, renewables, will succeed is by working with the utilities, not against the utilities. They are not the enemy. They are the solution of the whole thing. The Utilities Commission is trying to be supportive. And I don't believe in painting this whole thing black or white.
Before coming to North Carolina, Wilhelm worked for years in the publishing industry, where he had to work hard to gain consensus among many groups to help his business succeed. He says the same thing needs to happen here with solar energy. And until it does, a great source of energy will continue to be underutilized. Again, Ivan Erlaub of the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association.
We know from the real measured experience of nations around the world and other states in the United States that we could increase our use of renewable energy and energy efficiency fivefold with no problems right now, with no additional technological innovations, no new research and development. We can just use what we already have out there in the marketplace.
Erlaub says the state could be a leader both in its use of locally produced solar energy and in developing products and services for consumers. More renewable companies would mean more jobs for the state, but that has been slow to happen. Jessica Jones, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
North Carolina could get most of the energy it needs as a state from renewable sources, including solar and wind. That's according to a report published earlier this year by the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. But when it comes to producing wind energy that goes back into the grid, North Carolina is behind other states. In fact, there is only one utility-grade wind turbine in all of North Carolina. Again, here's Jessica Jones.
The turbine is perched on a hill on the outskirts of Appalachian State University's campus in Boone. To get a close look, you have to walk up a small gravel road to an enclosure surrounded by a chain-link fence. Professor Dennis Scanlon teaches classes on how to build turbines.
This is a modern wind turbine. It's an intermediate-sized turbine. It actually has a rated power output of 100 kilowatts.
Scanlon says the turbine produces enough power for 30 average homes per year, or 60 energy-efficient ones, and it's quite tall. In fact, it has become one of Boone's landmarks.
It stands on a white tubular tower that's 120 feet tall, and then the individual blades of the turbine are 34 feet long.
It's not too windy today, but the blades are spinning gently. The turbine was installed last summer after ASU students voted to add a few more dollars to their activity fees to fund renewable energy sources on campus. And it works pretty well. Scanlon points to a round concrete structure nearby that looks like an above-ground swimming pool.
All the power goes right into this transformer that's right next to where we're standing, and then goes right into the grid. And the power is used here on campus and here in the community of Boone to power the houses and other loads that we have here.
But this is the only location in North Carolina where wind energy is locally produced and fed back into the grid. It's estimated that 1,000 kilowatts of wind power lie untapped in the mountains, along with about 500 more on land along the coast. States nearby, including Tennessee and West Virginia, already have wind farms. Virginia is planning one. But North Carolina has yet to break ground. Brian Miles is with NC State Solar Center, which works to give the public more information about renewable energy sources in the state.
It's a complicated endeavor, and it's very region and site specific. And so it's really tough to compare us to other states because everything is so different everywhere.
Miles says here in North Carolina, the permit process for building wind farms is very complicated. Right now, interested developers must apply for permits from local counties and then a host of other state and federal agencies. And of course, utilities must also be willing to buy that power. Paul Quinlan is with the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association. He says that's why many national developers shy away from proposed projects here.
The North Carolina market is competing with Texas, it's competing with New England, it's competing with the Midwest. Internally, they rank order all their potential projects and will invest where they believe they're going to have the best outcomes and prospects and have the most successful and responsible projects. Because of the regulatory uncertainty in North Carolina, that's a risk for them going forward that they are very aware of and approach cautiously.
A bill in the legislature originally sought to streamline that permitting process for both eastern and western North Carolina, but as it passed through the Senate, some lawmakers amended it to add a ridge law that prohibits turbines on the ridges in the mountains, generally considered the best locations in the West for wind power. If that bill passes, North Carolina will have the most restrictive wind power development standards in the country.
We should build wind energy facilities where it's appropriate.
Senator Martin Nesbitt of Buncombe County is one of the legislature's most outspoken members against wind power in the mountains.
And there are plenty of places that are appropriate in this country. And we should not build them where it's inappropriate. The same way with power plants, the same way with nuclear plants, the same way with everything that we do, we should find an appropriate place to put them.
To Nesbitt and other people who want to protect pristine views of the mountains, the only appropriate place for a wind turbine is somewhere where it doesn't stand out. Even though many western counties have passed resolutions in support of mountain wind farms, it's an uphill battle to win over powerful lawmakers like Senate President Mark Basnight. He wants to see wind power developed in coastal areas, especially offshore.
That is the area that has gained my focus. Mainly because the greatest potential for generating wind will be there.
It's estimated that 55,000 megawatts could be generated by offshore projects. Basnight has helped provide funding for a pilot project sponsored by UNC Chapel Hill and Duke Energy that will build three utility-grade wind turbines in Pamlico Sound. Construction is expected to begin next year. And now that powerful lawmakers like Basnight have spoken positively about wind projects in coastal areas, many private developers are lining up to get a better look at North Carolina's coastline. Jessica Jones, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
You've been listening to North Carolina Voices, Tomorrow's Energy, a special from WUNC News. This series was edited by WUNC's interim news director, Brent Wolf. It was made possible in part by grants from Burt's Bees Greater Good Foundation, from Progress Energy, and from the contributions of WUNC listeners. There's more about this series, interviews about energy from the state of things, and information about the production and consumption of electricity in North Carolina online at WUNC.org. I'm Eric Hodge.